Accession number 20457, reel 20.
Brigadier Randall, reel 20. You're saying that you were gazetted into the Devons.
Yes.
What happened?
And so suddenly, I was ordered to go back to the UK. I think when I got to port side, there was some sort of signal. They suddenly realised that the Indian Army was losing all its experienced officers. I have an idea that was a signal arrived saying that Major Randall should go back or something, but I'm a bit vague about this. I seem to remember having a word with the OC ship troops, and I said, well, come on, I've been out there for bloody years. I want to get back home, and he said, right, I'll just throw this in the waste paper bottle. He just ignored it. Anyway, I never heard any more. So I got home.
What impression did England make on you when you got back after your long absence?
Well, it was pretty drab. I arrived back in, March. It was still about pretty drab and pretty austere, really. But, I mean, I hadn't seen my parents for over 5 years. I mean, 5.5 years, and so that was nice. My brother hadn't seen, well, I did see my brother because he came back on a hospital ship from the Pacific Fleet. I did fly over from Burma to see him in Bombay, but anyway, I got married, so that was all rather exciting. The whole mood was, everybody was sort of readjusting their lives. Lots of sort of meeting old friends and lots of parties and things. It was drab. It was all very pleasant, actually. And then I got posted for a short time to some training unit in Cornwall.
Would that be part of the DCLI?
Well, no, it was a thing called a PTC, a Primary Training Centre. It was in the old DCLI depot area, Victoria Barracks in Bodmin. But it was clear to me that I really, nice as it was to be keeping my rank as a boy major, it wasn't going to get me anywhere. I ought to get to the Devons, so I asked to go to the second Devons, who were in Germany.
Where were they?
They were in Lüneburg.
Mm. What were they doing when you joined them?
Not a great deal. It was all a difficult period because I'd come from a top class Indian battalion, and I hadn't had very much experience with British soldiers, so I had to sort of watch my step a bit. Second Devons, they were extraordinarily kind to me, and they really were. I came down. I gave up my temporary majority. Well, I'd have realised I'd do that. They were very, very kind, but the battalion was running down. There were constant groups and numbers coming up. There wasn't. I was posted second in command to a company of a chap who'd got far less experience than I had, but a nice chap. And I mean, I realised, in peacetime, you've got to, everybody comes down a bit, and I was quite content to be company second in command, where I could sit back and just get the feel of how one operated with British soldiers. There was a hell of a lot of black marketing going on. All the soldiers were doing was sort of black market and sort of shagging the German girls. Okay, I mean, I had no moral qualms with that, except that, but there wasn't very much training because I only worked in the morning. Every afternoon I used to play games or go shooting. It was fine because the war was over. It was probably a good time just to relax and charge one's batteries up. Well, I'm beginning to wonder. My wife came out, it was fun, and we went off on skiing holidays in Denmark. But I thought, well, now, this is all very well, but, you know, is this what you're going to do for the next rest of your life? And then all of a sudden they decided that second battalions of regiments were going to be placed in what was called suspended animation. And so I asked to go out to our first battalion of the Devonshire Regiment, which was in Hong Kong.
You said that you had to adjust to dealing with British soldiers. What were the differences between the requirements of dealing with British soldiers and Indian soldiers?
Well, you had to nursemaid British soldiers far more. You really had to far more sort of welfare problems. The Indian soldier didn't really have very many welfare. He had welfare problems, but you weren't the channel through which they were sorted out. Even in the Indian soldier tended to put his officers on a bit of a pedestal, and there you were friendly with them, talked to them. But you didn't have to you didn't really have to explain the reason for every order you gave. I don't say you did that with British soldiers, but it was getting adjusted to motivating them that I found difficult. Not difficult, but I had to watch, and you obviously had to go to greater lengths to explain what you were aiming to do and everything you did. Well, the Indian soldiers, they just accept me. If Saab said this, well, that was okay by me. One had to be much more mentally alert all the time. I didn't find too much difficulty, I must admit, but I felt it paid me to be a bit wary and not to sort of become the sort of a... I don't want to be in a position of course you're not sort of... You're dealing with WOG soldiers, you know, you can't treat... I didn't want to put myself in that position, and it never happened to me, but... It took a time to get the feel of things, really. I think soldiers, infantry soldiers, are much the same in any army, up to a point. I think if you were dealing with technicians, it might have been a different story, but they're fairly simple sort of chaps, actually. If you try and make it training things interesting. If you try and be, if as long as you're fair, and you're firm, they don't let you get away with it. And you've got a smile on your face and talk to them. I think it's much the same. Soldiers anywhere in the world, I like to think anywhere.
Were these soldiers mainly men from Devon?
No, because we had a whole lot of. See what happened. A wartime battalion of the Black Watch folded up. And everything was based on your run-out date. So it had a number of soldiers whose run-out date they still had time to do. So we about 200 jocks arrived. My company sergeant, not my army, I was second commander, but he was a jock. I could hardly understand what he said. You know, he brought that Norwegian accent. And we had the adjutant was an officer of the Black Watch. And then we had a lot of Royal Fusiliers. So the thing was an awful sort of mix-up, really. Later on, when the National Service came in, and lots of chaps from the West Country were called up. In the late 40s and 50s, we were about 90% or 100% West Country. But not in 46, it was. No, we were just a sort of... a rag bag of all sorts. The army was going through trying to get operate the demobskis on a fair basis, so that people went out on their, not because their unit happened to be disbanded and somebody else's didn't. I think the British Army got it right. I mean, I think the mistakes they'd made in the First World War were put right. And if everybody had a run-out date based on when he was called up and he went out on there, that was palpably fair. But it did give awful problems of how do you use the soldiers who in the unit disbanding, which have still got time to serve.
Did these different groups of soldiers from different regiments all get on reasonably well?
They didn't get on very well. There didn't seem to be antipathy, no. I mean, I think they all knew they got 6 months to do. There wasn't, certainly in the second, the officers were still saying, I mean, we had some jolly good officers, and good long service WOs. Who sensibly didn't try to sort of do anything too militarily ambitious. We had one whole company doing a thing called Operation Woodpecker, which was cutting down trees to keep the Germans supplied with fuel for the winter.
What condition were the Germans in?
Germans, even in Lüneburg, which wasn't a more prosperous place, they were in a pretty poor way. We used to go up to Hamburg a lot, and of course, I mean, you could still smell the unburied dead there. That saying all that sort of thing was quite a revelation to me, having come back from the Far East. But the Germans were obsequious, and they'd step off. If you're walking down the road, they'd step off the pavement to let you get through, which is an astonishing experience, really. I didn't like seeing starving children much. At least I didn't. Well, I don't think any of us did. That slightly worried us a bit. But, and of course, their cigarettes and chocolate were the sort of currency. I mean, I did a bit of minor black marketing myself. I got myself a radio set and used to go and get eggs. But I mean, that was the only way you could get any extra rations and things.
I was going to ask what the commodities were in the black marketing that you mentioned. Was it chocolate and tobacco?
That was your currency. Yes. Some people went in for. I won't say who it was, but one of them, I mean, really concentrated heavily on buying antiques. He got himself some very lovely rugs and some really rather handsome items of porcelain and that sort of thing. But most people just went for sort of radios and of course the soldiers went for women. There would be women, half a dozen women or more, a dozen outside the barrack gates. On the night when the fags were issued, just ready to flog themselves. So it was a fairly demoralising sort of situation, really, in a way.
Did you have any duties to perform as a battalion in Lüneburg?
I was company secretary command. I think I was a unit fire officer. I had to go off for a week and defend. I was defending also a German colonel on a war crime. When I say defending officer, he had a German consul, but I was called defending officer. I was assigned to him to see that he was treated fairly, that he was given an opportunity, that he wasn't sort of that he was given reasonable facilities to at the trial, and that he wanted to, his meals were brought up and so on, that sort of thing, which is an interesting thing.
What had he done? Or
well, I came. He had been commandant of a prisoner of war, a POW camp. I felt rather. His name was Oberst Schreller. He convinced me, having heard that, sat through the whole case, that he hadn't given them laundry the rations and things, but he convinced me by witnesses that in fact, I mean, that he and his German staff weren't any better off at all, really. And he certainly hadn't sort of tortured anybody or melted. His failings were lack of administrative ability, but certainly not a sort of not a deliberate act of brutality. I felt rather sorry for him, actually. I thought he behaved himself with some dignity. He didn't go down for very much.
And he was found, he was convicted.
He was found guilty, but he certainly convinced me that most of the, most of the faults were the whole crumbling of the German civil administration.
What sort of court was it that tried him? Was it a court martial?
It was a court martial. With a British colonel and two or three, and they had a JAG. I mean, it was conducted entirely properly. I felt it was a very dignified and civilized court. It was an interesting experience. But I mean, I imagine though they were going to. I come up against a chap who'd sort of torn prisoners limb from limb, and it was none of that at all, really. I mean, it was. I felt that they were rather wasting people's time. That they could. There were a lot more, very much more deserving villains around than this chap. But there were.
What were the soldiers doing then? What was their sort of daily routine duty?
Well, we had a lot of guard duties, you see. Mm.
What sort of things were you guarding?
Well, we were telling quarter guard. Mm. We did patrols up on the East German frontier, which was quite a popular thing to do. They'd set up a sort of British... with the East German border, which wasn't very far away. There was this sort of frontier group. They were sort of quasi-gendarmerie. And then we had to send motor patrols up from time to time just to sort of, to work under them, just to sort of patrol the borders. That was quite popular. But the strengths were running down all the time and we weren't getting reinforcements. So only about once every 3 weeks did you have enough chaps available to take them out and do a bit of musketry or a bit of training, really.
Did you see anything of the Russians?
Nothing at all, no.
And did you go up onto the border?
Yeah, I went up once, just out of interest, actually. Mm. And met these sort of, I can't remember the name, met this sort of, had this green uniform. He was a British chap, he was an ex-Palestine policeman, I think. Mm. Anyway, we patrolled around a bit. It was at least got out of barracks and out on the, it was along the Elbe.
Mm. Well, I mean, was anything happening along the frontier at that time?
Not really, not then, no. I mean, the East Germans hadn't, really, the East German government hadn't started sort of organising itself. Then I went on a lot of leave, and my wife came out, my child bride, and we went off 3 weeks skiing, and then I was able to take my company Land Rover all the way up to Copenhagen with my wife. And I mean, really, I had a pretty idle time. So very little was going on, really.
Were there any attempts to prevent fraternisation or close down the black market?
Well, I mean, orders were published from the brigade and division all the time. But, I mean...
That usually means no one's taking any notice.
I mean, you knew that comrade. It was rather like sort of farting against thunder. Mm. I mean, a lot of young soldiers about, not much time. Lots of attractive German women offering themselves. I mean, it was just a waste of time. Mm. And the same with black market. And I think most people felt, well, we'd won the war. Why shouldn't we have within reason? I mean, we weren't looting the stuff. We weren't going to houses and taking it. We were paying the going rate, in fact, it happened to be cigarettes and not marks, was beside the point. Nobody felt really that they were behaving. They may have been breaking the law, but they weren't really breaking any moral law. Mm. I think that's perfectly right, really.
Were you happy to be heading off out to the Far East again when you got posted?
Well, not really, because I couldn't take my wife with me. I felt a bit daft about it, but we discussed it. I mean, she could see the good sense that if I was going to be a regular officer, I had to get some experience of British soldiers, and I had to get sort of established in my regiment. So off I went to Hong Kong.
What happened to you when you arrived at the 2nd Battalion?
The 1st Battalion.
The 1st Battalion,
yeah.
Sorry.
Well, then I joined them, and they were out in the new territories, and I given command of support company.
What did support company have in it at that time?
Well, it only had mortars and a Pioneer platoon. It didn't have any machine guns. Now, they were in a similar condition. They're not quite as bad as the 2nd Battalion being in that demob groups were going away. The only difference was that reinforcements were coming out. So I took a draft of 30 or 40 chaps out with me on the boat going out to Hong Kong. So though we were losing soldiers, but there was far less in the way of guard duties, and we were able to do quite a lot of training, actually. I'd had no experience. I mean, I've never been a mortar officer myself or a pioneer officer. So as a company commander with two chaps who'd done some training, I was slightly feeling my way. Well, that was very pleasant, actually. But I was only there for about 3 months, and then we moved down to Singapore.
What sort of operations were you practicing for in the new territories? What did the training consist of?
Well, at that time, I mean, believe it or not, there was a definite probability that we as a battalion would be shipped up to go into Shanghai. The second in command was sent off on a British destroyer or cruiser, I think. He went off to do a recce. He was supposed to be sort of not an obvious officer, but he had a sort of trilby or pork pie, regimental blazer, regimental tie. I mean, great big from the start. I mean, anything, I mean, he was, no one, not even the Chinese, would be fooled by what. He went off up there, and we then one weekend stood by to go. Thank God we didn't go. I think they were trying to re-establish the treaty port there. But it would have been a very, it was still Chiang Kai-shek, of course, though.
International.
But it would have been a very hazardous operation, and I think God, we didn't go. And of course, the Chinese communists hadn't. I was able to, with some charms, we were able to go up by train to Canton without any difficulty. We had to get a pass, but southern China was still occupied by the Kuomintang. In a sense, we were training for training's sake, I suppose, really.
Was there any idea that Hong Kong might actually be in danger of invasion or attack?
None at all, no. No. I mean, the quote. I mean, if they were going to do it, I mean, the Kuomintang would have prevented us landing there, you know, back in the previous year. No, 18 months, 2 years before, but they didn't. No, I mean. There was certainly no defence plan. I don't quite know why we were stuck out. I think, to be honest, we were put out in the new territories because that's where there was suitable accommodation, rather than. But there was no. I'm quite sure there was no patrolling of the frontier, as there was once the communists occupied China. Well, of course we patrolled, but there was none of that there. I think we were just sort of just part of the garrison in the Far East, then.
What level of training were you doing? Were you doing purely battalion training, or did you go to a higher level, higher scale?
Well, there we were doing basically, we were basically doing a sort of individual training at that particular time.
Going through the cycle?
We were doing quite a range firing musketry, that sort of thing. As far as the support car, because of this constant flow of outgoing and new people coming in, you were, unlike in a regular battalion where once a year you have a cadre, 3-inch mortar cadre, signal cadre, MT cadre, you were constantly having to have perhaps two or three cadres a year. You obviously tried not to do this with support weapons because it takes time to train a chap up. But so that anything above sort of individual or training wasn't very practical, really.
How long does it take to train a soldier, a National Service soldier, to become a good mortar man?
Well, it didn't even take very long, really. One of the paradoxes, the National Servicemen, they weren't volunteer soldiers, but a lot of them were probably of a fairly high IQ. They were fairly intelligent, and some of them, a lot of them, were sort of people with some sort of craft background. And most of them thought, well, if I'm going to be a natural soldier, I might as well be a good one. And therefore, they adapted quickly, and they latched on to things, perhaps quicker than those days, the regular soldier, who was perhaps a steady old fire, but perhaps not quite so intelligent. Mm-hmm. So you gained in that respect. It didn't take all that long, really.
What were the duties? What was the role of the Pioneer Platoon?
Well, it was mostly explosives, mine clearance, and a certain amount of sort of they were tended to be used as a small engineer work service, really. The training areas in Hong Kong were limited to, even in those days, and it was quite a business getting permission to fire, because there wasn't any empty. And there was a sort of range out of a place called Lo Wu, but a lot of it, the local Chinese had animals and things, so you couldn't just go out and say, well, it would go out and fire next week. You had to sort of plan it all sometime in advance. So it wasn't really, to lay on any sort of imaginative or interesting training, wasn't at all easy, really. Mm-hmm. You were mostly just the sort of general area, just around the camp, really.
Sounds very restrictive, the circumstances. Mm. So you were basically having to concentrate on individual training and not get very much further.
Yeah.
Was there any notion that there might be an internal security threat in Hong Kong at that time?
Well, we didn't have a role. There were two other battalions there, the Buffs and the Inniskilling Fusiliers. The Inniskilling Fusiliers were down in Kowloon, and the Buffs were out on the island. I think there must have been an interior. I mean, I think that there must have been one, but just because it was a sort of standard procedure. But then there wasn't any civil unrest. I mean, the Chinese were too busy trying to organise themselves to make money.
Were you on?
And there was very little political. I mean, there was no noticeable political agitation of any sort.
Were you on good terms with the local Chinese population?
Oh yes, we used to go out sort of snipe shooting and quail shooting and go through their villages. They weren't. We weren't warmly greeted, but we weren't hostilely greeted. We still had to be a bit careful with the cameras. That was it, you see. The Chinese didn't like having cameras pointed at them, or some of them didn't, the evil eye and that sort of business. And I seem to remember being warned, you know, be very careful about taking snapshots because it offends them. So, but.